Okay, it is October 29th at 1:24 p.m. I'm here with Mary and Pook, and they are going to tell us their stories. So first, whichever one of you wants to start, feel free to tell me a little about the background, how you got involved in the LGBT community here in St. Louis, and then we can move on from there.
Okay. I got involved in the LGBT community in St. Louis when I came out, which was in the late 70s, and promptly met, actually met a lot of incredible people in the gay community, and two of whom, Connie Lane and Barbara Lau, with myself, were the founding mothers of Wired Women. And it totally began kind of an unplanned thing, I guess, that kind of emerged out of St. Louis had a very, I guess, feminist, strong feminist, how would you say, presence in St. Louis at the time. There had been things like Take Back the Night March against rape. That was in Benton Park. There was a bike event for the Equal Rights Amendment in Forest Park. And Harriet Woods was a state politician from St. Louis running. And so there were, I think the Wired Women came out of that feminism of people wanting to, at that time, bars were mostly the places to network and meet up with other LGBT people. And we weren't settling for that. We wanted
to... Because they were men, male bars mostly.
Exactly.
And or, if you don't mind if I step in, in my experience, well, I came out in the 70s too, and I worked for a theater group in town called Theater Project Company, and that's where I met Connie and Barbara. I was a technician, theater technician, and an actor, and we met during a play. And in my experience, there wasn't safe space for women to gather, bar-wise, because there were some women's bars, but they were really rough and really scary. You know, it would be lots of we called them diesel dykes. They were rough, and they. You'd walk in and go right back out because it was kind of scary. And Connie and Barbara and Mary were trying to create safe space where women could gather and drink and eat and dance safely.
Right.
And it went from there, I guess.
Yeah. And it started really not us setting out to do that so much. We did want to have some events, some social events mostly, and I was a music fanatic. I had lots of records, and I was a closet DJ, I suppose, at the time, whereas the other two were more, they were really into theater and production. Barbara, who was a WashU alum, she was from Cleveland, Ohio. She moved here to go to WashU. She was assistant curator for folk arts at the Jefferson Expansion Memorial Historical Association at the Arch. So she was really into folk life stuff. And eventually, later on, she left St. Louis to work as program coordinator for the Smithsonian Institution's Festival of American Folk Life. So, and then Bart and Connie was working with Theater Project Company. So they had a lot of production skills and things like that. So
that's where the Wired came from.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and so they, we all were on the same page in that we really liked a sense of community, and it basically started by the us requesting from the bar that lesbians were frequenting that time, Genesis 2, now the site of Jiffy Lube in the Grove, and going to them because we were really frustrated. We'd go there, it would be... the mostly gay men DJing, and it would be, music is pretty personal, but it would be a lot of instrumental, like boom, 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 that kind of music, which we...
Pounding.
I called, in my narrative, had a name for it, so you'll see that. cock rock is what we called it. And, you know, for example, like women, we wanted some women's energy. We wanted some slow dances. There were some good, you know, there's songs like My Girl and Sexual Healing and things like that. Not boom, 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 let's go back to my room, which was a big gay men's song at that time. So that's how it started. We were denied an opportunity. We had an idea that, hey, maybe on a certain night we can come in here, bring some records and spin records and have a women's night. They didn't buy that. So
they said no.
Yeah. And Connie and Barbara had some connections with Heartbreak Hotel, some of the folks down there, so that's kind of how it started. We had a one-time event, Sister Solstice Strut, in June of 1983, and that bar is just south of Busch Stadium, downtown, and it turned out there were 34 women showed up. Were you at that first
game? Yes.
Yeah, we were. We were. Called it the Sister Solstice Strut.
Because it was summer solstice.
Yeah. And we rented equipment from a place on South Jefferson, schlepped it over there, and we cleared 16. I think there were 30-something people there, 34 people. And we cleared $16 and some change. But the great there was great energy there. You got a lot of encouragement. We schlepped all these records down there. We had those old wooden crates of, you know, that you'd use for vinyl. And I guess the best thing, the crowds, so what happened was it was supposed to be a one-time event, and then in September of that year, the owners of Heartbreak said, well, let's have every other Thursday night. So from September of 1983 till the end of that year, we had dances every Thursday night.
And in those days, the Thursday was significant. It was Thursday was the queer day.
Queer day. Supposed to be queer. Especially if you wore
green and yellow.
Green. Yeah. So our mantra was that women's night was not the same as ladies' night. And so I think that pretty much says it all. So that's kind of how it started. And I've noted in my narrative that there was a production company called Red Tomato, some St. Louis folks who was producing some concerts which featured lesbian artists, and they were kind of phasing out at that time. But because we started doing these events, and I think it was probably, it was $1.50 admission for the first one, and here's the flyer from when dances started in September, so we were every other Thursday. And then in 1985, we started having weekly dances because the guy at Heartbreak said, when you're not here, on the Thursdays you're not here, women are coming down here anyway looking for you guys. So he said, let's just do it. So we did. And so then we started to accumulate some revenue. Mailing list grew to over 800 quickly. And we joke about, you know, it was your neighborhood too, but the 63110 zip code in St. Louis, which is near in the Shaw neighborhood, was referred to as
Dyke Heights.
Dyke Heights, because that's where probably 90% of our mailing lists, a good percentage of them lived in that neighborhood. So, and I think
safe neighborhood, cheap rent.
Yeah, there you go. And I think what was happening in St. Louis along the feminist lines is there were a lot of people coming out in my generation, and there were a lot of women who moved here from other cities to go to college here, either WashU or Webster College at the time. Now it's Webster University, which was a very liberal fine arts school, or very liberal arts school. And so I think when it was the synergy of the locals and these feminist, educated, intelligent women who could get things done, it was kind of the perfect, perfect storm, the perfect blend, I think, in some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there were some lesbian bars that emerged, but not many, and so we had quite a following for quite a while, and it was kind of like the Little Rascals started making money, like, what are we going to do with it? Well, let's put on a play, because Connie Lane was a director, and
Well, one of the...
Yeah.
Kate Clinton was first, though, right before the play,
yeah,
wasn't she?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When they started getting the money going, it was still at Heartbreak Hotel that they decided to bring Kate Clinton, who was a fairly established already comedian, stand-up comic.
Actually, the play was first. The play
was it really?
April 1984.
Oh, I am so sorry.
Kate was in May, so it was right around the same time.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's right, because the whole cast was at the Heartbreak Hotel after the closing. I'm sorry. Yeah. Bluefish Cove was first.
Yeah. So I'll shoot that over to Fook because she was one of the stars.
Last summer at Bluefish Cove was a play written about a lesbian resort in the Northeast. It was written by Jane Chambers. And we performed it in one of the small theater spaces downstairs of Webster. It was everybody's story was in it. It was really well written and quite explicit. It was about half of the women didn't use their real names in the program, and there was hate mail and murder threats. And it was a little scary on opening night to walk out there and know you're going to do something that might on stage that might offend someone. But it was a beautifully written play, and everybody cried at the end because the lead, I was Lil, the lead, and she dies of cancer. Elegantly.
With a flair,
yes. And that generated a lot of attention. I think, I don't know whether it was sold out every night, but I believe it might have been. And then that's the money that you used to bring Kate in town.
I
had that backwards.
Okay. And also in the play, Joan Lipkin, who, I don't know if you've heard her name around town, but she's a
playwright.
The director of that Uppity Theater Company and the Disability Project.
Mm-hmm.
She was also in that play, as well as about six or seven other locals.
Four couples, so it was eight.
Yeah. So, anyway, highly successful. But, you know, the consistency of having something every week bringing in revenue, even though it was only $1.50 or $2 or something, you know, we were able to fund that play, start bringing... Kate Clinton is one of the most notorious, I guess, the most notable lesbian comics in national... on a national tour, and also we eventually were able to purchase our own sound equipment that we use for concerts with big Bose speakers that we schlepped all over the place, and DJ equipment, a whole, you know, turntables, everything. And eventually, when we converted over to CDs, we did that too. So that continued through 1984, the weekly dances at Heartbreak, and we had a couple shows down there also on the stage. And in January of 1985, we showed up with the sound equipment. They have a dance, and there was a big barricade on the door that Heartbreak Hotel had closed. So, keeping with its name, Heartbreak, we were heartbroken. And so kind of had to shift gears, and as Wired Women did over the years, in April of that year, we were able to secure some space at the First Unitarian Church on Waterman to have some dances, and they continued there for a couple years. Some other concerts were that year also at the Learning Center, which was on Westminster. So there was almost like a corridor through central St. Louis, going downtown through the West End is kind of where we staked out that area. Although we had some stuff at St. John's Church on Arsenal and some places in U City also. So the First Unitarian Church was gosh, for almost 4 years, as I'm looking through this list, was a pretty solid, you know, venue for us. So we would typically at that time produce a couple concerts, two or three concerts a year. And then the other kind of traditional thing was in June we would have a gay dance during Gay Pride weekend, and the proceeds from that dance would go to the Pride Committee. And at the end of the narrative, and that was a standard with Ward Women.
Yeah, a lot of them were fundraisers. Some of the money always, I think, almost always went to a needy group.
And I alphabetized the list on the latest copy for you of different groups, you know, that were the beneficiaries. And because of
women
that...
Women shelters, HIV clinics, that sort of thing.
Everything, yeah. And as a result of that, I have a whole file here of thank you notes and letters from different agencies and people. You know, kind of gives you an idea. I'm really glad I kept those, but, you know, so you can look through those later. Here's your assignment, your next assignment. Can we make jokes on this? Okay, yeah. Good. Okay. Basically, it was a pretty dynamic thing because
exciting.
We were always having to adjust. We had no physical home, and that is the reason why we were able to have such a long tenure. We didn't have overhead of an office. We all donated our services for mailings a lot frequently at Pook's house in the Shaw neighborhood on Flora Avenue, where they have the
Flora Place
where they have the Shaw Arts Fair every year. I always walk right by your old house.
Yeah,
but we would typically we had a, you know, core group of volunteers, and we just call people, they'd show up, we do the mailings, and Pook started creating all the artwork that we have, and I have a lot of that here too. Yeah, typically, you know, flyers and things like that through the years, different dances, and, you know. So we have posters for a lot of that stuff, too, which will be turned over to the museum. So one thing that I want to mention is we did seek out, there were some men's gay bars that allowed us to come in and have like a women's night. Mitchley's, which was an incredible place down in Lafayette Square, 1000 Mississippi. We had some outstanding dances there. And later on, Knights, which was on Vanaventer. And then Twist, which was another club downtown on Washington Avenue. And that was later on. But around the same time, we were still using the Unitarian Church for dances. We secured the Sheldon Concert Hall on Washington Avenue and Grand Arts for some events. And So the concert production was increasing, kind of almost like the dances were decreasing a little bit, but the concert and the event production was increasing with comics, musicians. There's a whole network of lesbian artists that, who was it? They all had run a record, Olivia Records was a lesbian, was a producer, record.
Label.
And a lot of their artists were on that tour and on that circuit. the Sheldon was another great opportunity. And typically, then we kind of started this format, this tandem of having a concert downstairs in the concert hall, which is nationally renowned for its acoustics. It's acoustically perfect. And then
built for organ recitals, wasn't
it? Was
it?
Was
I think so.
And then a dance upstairs following in their ballroom.
Because there was a ballroom upstairs. It was perfect.
And that format became, like, incredibly popular. And all of our events were non-smoking. And
had child care.
Yep, free of child care. And they were always interpreted for hearing impaired people. So we were kind of cutting edge in that way. And also the rave part that we kind of moved around a lot. You know, where are they now? Where are they now? And Michael Kaluran, who is one of the founders of the Gateway Men's Chorus, told told me once that Gateway Men's Chorus totally modeled themselves after Wired Women. Like before,
I didn't
because
know that.
They would have concerts at the Sheldon, and they would have a dance upstairs afterwards. So that was really nice to hear.
That was a great space because we'd have it all day, moving, loading in, obviously, and the whole ballroom could be decorated with whatever the season or the holiday was, and balloons dropping from the sky and all from the ceiling and all of that sort of thing, which adds a dynamic to it.
So the amazing thing is that we all had day jobs. I was a high school guidance counselor at Afton High School. I started like in 1985, and I was a varsity volleyball coach, and so I had a pretty full life. I was finishing my master's degree. I was in school a couple nights a week. We were young and energetic.
I worked at a print shop doing the graphics and burning plates.
So we all had